Well, good afternoon. Welcome to 360 Coaching. This is another episode with John Christmas the Fourth, and today we got lucky enough to do an interview with the person that really mentored me into this entire field, and I get quite lucky to have him, Mr. Kevin Buck. Kevin Buck is an executive coach, and I'm going to kind of let him introduce himself and kind of go through everything, you know. So, Kevin, welcome to 360 Coaching, and go ahead and just tell the listeners a little bit about yourself.
I'd be happy to do so. Good to be here with you, John. Always a pleasure to meet with you. My background as an executive coach really came from an opportunity of working with people for quite a long time. And part of my background is I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist. And so I did that as a clinician for 15 years. I taught at Pepperdine University for 12 of those years in the graduate school. But one of the things that I noticed was that it's primarily women who come to therapy and not men. And I was doing a lot of work with men and men's groups and that, and I thought there's got to be a different way of doing this. And I reached out to a friend who was doing some coaching stuff, and she said, you should go to the International Federation for Coaching. They have a conference every year, and it was in Florida. So I went out to Florida in 1999 and got exposed to coaching. I came back, and not unlike what I usually do, I ended up starting to teach coaching to people. I co-taught a course with the Executive MBA program through the Grazia Dio School with Pepperdine. And really, the rest of it is kind of history. So I've been doing executive coaching for, I guess, 16 years now. And I started my own business in 2006 called Emergent Success, where we do executive coaching, strategic facilitation, and leadership education, all under the umbrella of collaborative leadership services. So really helping people work better together as they try to accomplish what they're trying to accomplish in their business.
Now, I get lucky enough to know kind of how you created the name Emergent Success, but I actually really like the name, so I'd love for the listeners to know how you came up with that name, because I really like it. So.
My wife, Janet, and I, she said, at one point, she said, I think you should start your own business. And I said, great. And so she actually called me up and said, I'm sitting here with a lawyer to do the filing for the business. What do you want to call it? So I'd love to tell you that it was a great in-depth 2-3-4 week process, but I tell people it was almost like having a gun to your head and having to come up with your business name, which saves you a lot of time in some ways. So I came up with Emergent Success because I had done a lot of work in the field of complexity science, and I like the idea of really helping people create the right environment for success to emerge. And so that's what Emergent Success is we come in and help you create the right environment for you to experience your own success, thus Emergent Success.
Yeah, and I get lucky enough because I really like that name. So when I came up with 360 Coaching, it was inspired mostly because I wanted to take all these coaching backgrounds, find the most common themes I could, not only create a podcast, but a whole company around. It's not just one type of coaching that benefits all. So that was kind of the unique part about when I was creating that. I actually had time, but yeah. Gun to my head, I think I'd still call it 360 Coaching because like it. But so I've had a lot of listeners and followers that reach out and always like to ask, you know, how is it when I first getting started in this business, how do I find clients or how do I do these things and how do I even educate myself in this field? I know your background is so unique, but explain the process of how you got, you know, from marriage and family therapy to coaching. You know, how did you make that transition and what did you feel like you needed to educate yourself on in doing so?
That's a great question. So how I did it, you have to realize I did it so long ago that things weren't in place that are in place nowadays. So that's a different ball game. And so this is one of those times where I often tell people, do as I say and not as I did, because I didn't have the opportunity to do that in some ways. So some of it for me was I went to the ICF conference, and I set a goal of presenting there 2 years later, which I did, and I presented to their master certified coaches level, which was the first time they had done that. At that time, in 99, early 2000s, the only thing that really existed was the International Coaching Federation and some mentoring associations, but people had been doing this work. They just didn't have a name for it. And so it was early on in terms of birthing this new practice. And a lot of it was under the umbrella of life coaching to begin with. And then what happened is you had people in organizations begin to look at executive coaching. So how is it that we could work one-on-one with an executive in an organization to help them be a better leader and perform better going forward? So that became part of the question, and an executive coaches began to fill that role. Now, from a developmental perspective, that happened primarily as a way for people to address problems. So executive coaching in its infancy was really about, we have a problem with John. We're not sure if we're going to keep him. We've tried everything we can. We're going to throw him a coach. Maybe that'll do it. That's kind of our last ditch effort to kind of save him here in the organization. So have at it. See if you can be successful with that. So it was primarily at the beginning about fixing people. And then what happened is people began to see the value of the coaching in terms of really developing people. And so I think in a lot of professions, it takes a while for that to happen, and it's gotten there in coaching. So I felt like the marriage and family therapy background was great because a lot of people who got into coaching had only a background of working with individuals. And one of the distinctions I make in working with executives is that you need to know not only the individual, but the organizational. You need to have a systems view of how things work, because you need to understand that this is not life coaching. I'm not sitting here with you, John, saying, what do you want to do with your life? And what does that look like? And how are you doing better body, mind, spirit integration in your life or something like that? This is really about executive coaching is about you performing your job at a higher level in the organization in order to move the organization forward. Is that going to be helpful to you? Yes. And is it expected to be helpful to the organization? Yes, also. So it's a both and. It's not an either or.
And he says very key things, because I came from a complete world of strength and conditioning. So I like to think of executive coaching more like strength and conditioning, long-term, better results, versus the CrossFit way of doing things, which is incredibly short-term and try to get as much as you can for the quickest time possible. So that's kind of my analogy between life coaching and executive coaching. Both have their benefits, but executive coaching to me has always been a long-term solution with more productive results. Mm-hmm. And it has nothing to do with an individual. It has a lot to do more with organizations. So, that's kind of where I took it. But going forward from there, when you're working with companies, do you have a particular, when you step in, because I know you have a very unique background with the books you've read and the education you've had. When you're stepping into organizations, I always like your 360 approach. So since this is a 360 coaching, I'd love to know what you do when you step into an organization, because I know you do a lot of that.
Well, I think part of it is that when you asked the question earlier, how do you get clients, how do you get started, that kind of thing, a lot of this is built on reputation. So people have, no one has come to me for executive coaching through my website as of to date. And I've had my website for 10 years. So, and we just redid it. So it's good to have. It's just that people are going to know you by your reputation. Have you done good work? And usually what happens is you go into an organization and very common is that they give you the toughest gig possible and see what you can do with it. And if you can be successful with that, then hey, we're willing to throw you other things. I think the other thing too is that you have to be clear about what you're willing to offer and what you're willing to do. So one of the things that I talk about with clients is I could be the world's best coach, but the person who you're hiring me to work with has to have the desire to make the changes that you're talking about. Because I look at it as desire and ability. So I can have world-class ability to be helpful as an executive coach, but if you have no desire, nothing's going to happen. In the same way, your work, if you're working with someone in strength and conditioning, if you you have an incredible background, an incredible resume, but if they're not willing to do the work, if they're not willing to do the workouts and that, those kinds of things, not put in some effort, nothing's going to really happen. So I get really clear with the organization about, A, does this person have the desire to really make the change? Because if they don't, we're not going anywhere. Next step is really, what are the desired outcomes? Let's have some clarity and let's co-create it. So emergent success, collaborative leadership services. So there's always a collaboration with the client to look at what it is that we're trying to co-create together so that we have clarity going forward. And then maybe to your point about 360, one of my favorite instruments is interview 360. Because I find that if I go out and talk to people in the organization and not just do an online survey, that I get much better feedback. Actually, later this afternoon, I'm going to be meeting with a client where I just interviewed 12 people in the organization, and I'm going to be sharing that feedback. And oftentimes, that's a rather challenging task because people are a lot more honest in an interview. And I have a methodology that's really pretty simple. I only ask 10 questions, and then that gives me all that I need to know, usually to work with a client. And then after the interview 360, we then sit down together and co-create a coaching plan. So we get really clear about what we're trying to accomplish based on the feedback they've received.
And I love that word co-creation. I use a lot. And for those of you who have seen my YouTubes and those, I like that word, but I want you to know I learned it from Kevin, so I stole that. So that's one thing I want, you know, to give him credit for, but I like that word. Can you go in depth onto what that means to you? Because co-creation is probably one of my favorite terms in coaching. So, you know, I'd love to hear your side on all that.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. My my wife comes from a business banking background, and when I started using that term, she thought it was rather frou-frou. Until about 5 years ago, it was on the cover of Harvard Business Review, and I finally had credibility from my own wife around the term. So. She uses it all the time now also, but you know, she wasn't using it 5 years ago because she didn't like it. It sounded too frou-frou to her. Co-creation to me is really honoring the fact that any time that I work with someone, that I'm working with them. And so one of the ways that I describe collaboration is collaboration at its heart is really something that you do with someone and not something that you do to someone. And so if you really honor the with that, then part of it is that you co-create with them what they desire. The nice thing about doing that is that when you co-create with someone, they have more ownership for what's going to happen. They own it. And then one of the things that I like about that is in business, we have a lot of language around buying and selling, or that, you know, I have an initiative that I want to push to you, John, and I need to get your buy-in for that and all that kind of stuff. And it's like the great thing about co-creation is if you co-create it, people own it and they have their own accountability for it. It completely eliminates the need to do any buying or selling. I can't sell you anything that you already own. Would you like to buy your car again from me? No, Kevin, I own my car. It's like, there's no need to do that. So the co-creation really sets up, to me, the right environment of accountability and ownership and also a working relationship that really allows you to be much more effective.
Yeah, and that's, for me, you know, working with a lot of sports teams, I've seen that, because the reality behind the great teams, coaches, anybody in reality is always going to look at how do we make something together, how do we push forward, because when winning and losing is going to start coming into the battle, especially in pro sports, you got to co-create something together, and if you don't, you'll see what happens. I mean, those teams really will never succeed, but, you know, hitting on those points, and then when you're stepping in. Now, when you're actually in an organization and you're working with them, what are probably the most common themes you see when you go into a company? Like, what are the issues that you see most when you've done these 360 reviews or you're working with these companies? What are like three common themes you see? Like, if it was communication or any of those things, like, what do you see the most when you come into these companies?
That's a great question. Three common themes. So just to give you a context, nowadays, when I do executive coaching, I'm mostly doing executive coaching in the C-suite, CEO, CFO, whatever it is, in whatever industry it's working in. So I'm usually working at the highest level in the organization. So to me, that's different than maybe VP, director, manager, first-time manager level. So that's, to me, that's an important distinction to make. So what do I see there? I would say the most common theme is someone has moved in the C-suite from an operational job to a strategic job. They have moved up in the organization because of their operational excellence. They haven't moved up in the organization because of their strategic excellence. So their operational excellence is a default setting for them. And now that they're in the C-suite, they're asked to be a lot more strategic. And that's a very different skill set. And they may not have developed that primarily because they've been working with their operational excellence all these years, and that is their default setting. So that's a big thing, is really helping executives recognize that they have that, and it's not a matter of becoming strategic or operational. It's a matter of being operational and strategic, with the emphasis now in the C-suite that you're much more strategic in terms of what you're trying to accomplish. The second thing I would see is, at the level I work, is executive presence. So how do you come across as an executive? And I kind of define executive presence as everything that you do or don't do, and everything you say or you don't say, is your executive presence. Because when executives interact with people in the organization, you're being watched all the time. And if you're not communicating clearly, and communication certainly comes into under the subheading of executive presence, then people make up stories. You didn't say anything about that. Or I don't know what he means about that. I think he might want X. I think he might want Y. So one of the things that I help executives with is really creating clarity about what it is that they're trying to communicate to the people that they're interacting with. And in absence of making that as clear as possible, people will make up stories. And those stories may not be helpful to you being successful with your strategy. So, since you have the opportunity to influence that a great deal, why not leverage that as best you can? And here are some of the things that you may want to pay attention to. The other thing, I think the last thing I would say that I see is that executives around the communication really struggle with the fact that they may need to still listen to people. So they get accustomed to talking. And so I picked this up, and I, if I knew who to give this credit to, I would. But I often use a little thing called WAIT with executives. And WAIT stands for, why am I talking?
Perfect.
So it's just a little thing where it's like, just ask yourself that question, because what happens is, because of a certain level of importance, they feel like they need to be the ones who are talking all the time. And what they end up doing is not doing much listening. Now that doesn't, if there's all talking and no listening, that's not a very collaborative environment. That's not a very co-creative environment. And it's more of a command and control environment. And it isn't a successful environment in any organization nowadays.
And that's one thing that I've seen more and more with, now that I'm following the Harvard Business Journal, all this stuff, there almost seems to be this transition that we still have this command and control from the top down. And I know you talk a lot about, instead of doing vertical leadership, do horizontal. And I mean, I really like horizontal leadership. I'm still educating myself on it. But what is it that you see in terms of the vertical versus the horizontal, and how that whole thing is changing in the companies now that they're starting to switch to?
Well, I think command and control was a way of organizing and managing people. And I think what has happened, because we are recognizing how connected we actually are, and how much we aren't really siloed in any organization, we just pretend like we are, that if we want to get more integrated results, and I'll tell you, I can't name an industry where they don't want more integrated results, then you can't get to integrated results by just telling people what to do. I love a speaker I heard decades ago saying, if telling people what to do was an effective strategy, you think the Ten Commandments would be a lot more effective.
It's true. Yeah.
So whenever I get to command and control, I think of that and go, that's a good example. So what has happened is people sometimes have managed operationally in more of a command and control kind of manner, and then they get to a higher level in the organization, and leadership is now more by influence. The other language that we hear out there is that you have what they're called matrixed relationships, which means that you and I, John, work together. We're in the same organization, but you don't directly report to me. But I need you to be successful in what I'm trying to accomplish. So we have a matrix relationship that the organization expects us to honor and work well together in order to accomplish the business goals. And it's up to us to do that. So the horizontal shift is really helping people become better coaches as leaders, to be better facilitators of the work. A lot of the work that I do is not only individual, but also team coaching. So how do I work with this team to work better together going forward? Because they probably don't know how to do that. So just telling people, I think you need to work better as a team. That's probably helpful feedback or information, but that doesn't help me know how to do it. And so if people have come up in an organization in a very vertical kind of way and manner, my best guess is it may not have had an exposure to more of the horizontal way of working, which is really bringing people together, having collaborative processes, having ways of engaging people so that you're really getting them to own what's happening and that you just facilitate that going on as opposed to being in charge of it. You really facilitate the work. So it's a very different approach.
Yeah, and I mean, when I was in strength and conditioning, there was none of that we think across. It was really pretty much command and control. And my work with, you know, coaching people on health has been very different because now you take an approach from not only how do you want to be healthier in terms of exercise, but how do you want to be healthier overall? Mm-hmm. And when you ask the questions, I find that you're going to get really, really good actions from people. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily the answers I'm interested in, but the actions. And, you know, I always like asking for any coach, what are your favorite questions to ask someone where you feel you get probably the most in-depth actions from that person?
In terms of questions, I think part of it is really, you know, one of the things that I do is in the coaching plan, look at what are your desired outcomes? What would you like to get out of this? And when you begin to do that, then you kind of co-create the different layers of what people really want. So the other thing is that I also know that people are on a continuum of change all the time. Based on my last coaching conversation, as much as I can summarize and say, okay, this is what the action items are from today, and this is what I see you doing, so on and so forth, great. If I think that nothing has happened in that person's life between now and the next time I see him, I'm probably wrong. So I'll give you a concrete example. Coaching a guy who works in a technology company who's in charge of, it's a multi-billion dollar company in charge of their global real estate. And one of the things that he says, you know, the company is changing. I need to approach this in a different way. My job title has changed, my responsibility has changed. I need a thinking partner for how to think about this. I said, that sounds great. Well, why don't we do that next time we get together in 2 weeks? So I'm walking into the coaching appointment thinking that we're gonna talk a little bit about how to create that, how to co-create that. Instead, he ended up wanting to talk mostly about his health and some health issues. And then he got into this thing about, I need a way of grounding myself and slowing down. Do you know anything about meditation? and so we had a completely different conversation than I thought we were going to have. Now, I would like to say that's exceptional. And in my years of experience of being a therapist and an executive coach, it's not exceptional. So I just have to You know, I had a moment where I'm walking back out to my vehicle after the appointment going, well, that's not exactly what I thought we were going to talk about today. So, yeah. But it's not the first time, so that was okay. So some of it is meeting the client where they're at. So that was more important to them, to him, than co-creating a strategy, because it's really about how is he going to take the best care of himself so that he can perform for that organization. Not unlike what you do with individual athletes, what are they going to do to bring their skills and abilities up to the highest level so that they can most fully contribute to the team and organizational goals of winning a championship or whatever it might be. So it was very, you know, he wasn't concerned about the strategy about winning, but it's like, I want to make sure I'm at my best. Okay. Excellent.
And that's so often what I've run into, and you certainly know this from just being in a therapy side. When I have an athlete in front of me, everyone thinks that I talk to them a lot about sports and a lot of things. I will rarely talk to them about what their given profession is. It will always be something that relates to probably their family or some other things that are probably a little bit out of their control, but it's always interesting how much I'll never talk to them about what they do. And they seem to get a lot healthier from it because they at least know some action steps to go from there. But It's always been interesting that they rarely want to talk about their sport. They want to talk about a lot of other things because they talk about their sport all day long. So it's been interesting. Trent, kind of taking an off swing to this now. I always like talking about personal development. So I always love hearing coaches' personal development plans for themselves. You know, what they do to keep themselves, you know, up on the research or whatever it is. What is it your plan that you do that just helps yourself either relax or continue in the research or whatever it is you do for a personal development plan?
A great question. It's a lot of things. So you know me well enough to know that one of the things that I do is I pay attention to my health. And so working out, nutrition, so on and so forth, that's been in place my entire life. I really see taking good care of my body as a foundational piece. And if I can discipline myself there, I can discipline myself anyplace else. That's just the way I look at it. So when I've been in, for instance, when I was going through my licensing exam as a marriage and family therapist, it was a lot of work, and I was it was a lot of hours. And when I look at trying to achieve a goal like that, the first thing I do is I work in on my calendar how I'm taking good care of my body, because that's what gets me there. It's the vehicle that gets me there, so to speak. So that's foundational for me. The other piece is that my undergraduate degree is in theology. So I've done a lot of spiritual development work over the years. And so I have regular time for meditation and quiet. The other thing that I have done over the years is that I reach out to people for help. So I have an executive coach that I've worked with for years. I have a spiritual director who's actually a Tibetan Buddhist Lama that I have phone calls with on a regular basis. I shared this in a presentation last night. I said one of the things I came to realize is that a lot of us who get into this profession are very good at taking care of other people, but we're not that good at receiving. So we're good caregivers. We're not the best care receivers. And one of the most humbling experiences for me was that I was rear-ended in a car accident and I was having lower back pain. I was very athletic. I was very biased. I thought people who had lower back pain are just complaining too much and being babies about this, and that they just did more strength and conditioning, that symptom would go away and they'd be fine. And I went to the gym and tried to take care of it, and I still had lower back pain. And if you've ever been through chronic lower back pain, you get to a point where anything sounds like a good idea. And so someone said, have you ever gotten a massage? And I said, no, but I'd be willing to try it. So I'm on the massage table, I'm laying on my back, the massage therapist has her hands underneath my head, and she said, it's our first session, she said, so what are you doing? I said, well, at that time I was a marriage and family therapist. Oh, so you're someone who takes care of other people. I said, yes. She said, just like you're trying to take care of me by holding your head up. Now, the great thing about that was you can't lie your way out of that. I mean, there's no language to get you out of that. So she was dead right. I mean, I was doing that. And so one of my practices is for the last 22 years, I've received a monthly massage as a way for me to practice being a good receiver. And it's been great for my body. I mean, I think it makes a huge difference. I also do an enormous amount of reading. So I read in a lot of different disciplines, whether it be complexity science, whether it be in the healthcare field, whether it be in leadership development, whether it be in spirituality, psychology. So I've been a very curious human being all my life, and I've always been a very avid reader. And so being in this field and doing the work I do, it really works well that I'm the kind of reader that I am. So I'm always have books that I'm reading at one point or another. So, and the other thing is I get exposed because I've been around, I get exposed to different people and have worked with different people that I get to learn different ideas at sometimes a national and international level, which has been great for me. So I'm very grateful for that.
Yeah, and it is interesting as I've seen more, especially from the strength coach, Pilates instructors, and now that I've gotten into doing health coaching and leadership and all other stuff, I have seen so many strength coaches who have chronic pain and so many Pilates instructors who have monumental amounts of stress. And I've adopted much better things, probably now because I also have a fiance that watches out for me a lot more than I usually watch out for myself, but I take care of myself much better. And the stress levels have gone down monumentally, and it's been a tremendous help to have a personal development plan. And the books, just so we also do know, listeners, Kevin is the one that turned me on to a lot of the books I read and suggest to you guys. So just letting you know, books like Liberating Structures and Teaming and all those other books that I've suggested, he has turned me on to a lot of them. So his reading list is far more extensive, but you guys will get a lot more suggestions probably from him in the future as I email him more and more books when I finish them. But taking that swing into, you know, learning to educate yourself and learning things, where do you see, so leadership coaching has become really a pretty big phenomenon now. Mm-hmm. Where do you see it going in these next, you know, years to come and stuff, now that they've been turned on so much to it for the Fortune 500s and everybody now, where do you see this field going to, whether it be good, bad, and different, or, you know, where do you see the field pushing now?
Well, I think when we started out, I talked about developmentally, where it's, where executive coaching started and was trying to fix people. And I think one of the things that you see nowadays is you see that it's really become integrated into the way that people do things. I have a leader that it was a CEO of a multi-billion-dollar company, and he says, you know, I can't even imagine bringing someone into the C-suite and not giving them an executive coach or having a coach themselves and so on and so forth. So I think it's become much more integrated because I think one of the things that happens at the highest level in organizations is that as you move up in the organization, you get less honest feedback. And we just know that. Everyone knows that. We don't want to say the emperor has no clothes. And so the coach sometimes is that person who can give that honest feedback, and you become more of a thought partner with them. So it's not as much corrective or even sometimes developmental. It's really having someone that you trust that you can become a thought partner to. So most of the CEOs that I work with, I feel like we get to a place where it's almost a thought partner. I had an idea. I don't know who else to run this by, so can I run it by you and get some feedback about it? Absolutely, of course. So that's one way of going. I think the other thing that we're seeing is that coaching came along and has been around for probably a good 10, 15, 20 years, and it's been primarily a upper-level management experience, and it's been developed and delivered by baby boomers. And I think the next trend that we're seeing and what I'm trying to address in my own practice in my own company is, what do we do with the millennials? Well, part of it is that millennials don't want to be coached by baby boomers. They don't want to be coached by their parents, so to speak.
Yeah.
So, which is fair, but what we need to do is we need to begin to identify who are those younger people who might want to get into executive coaching so that we have millennials who are able to work with millennials? Not unlike we've had baby boomers to work with baby boomers, so to speak. Now, can you work cross-generational? Absolutely. And I think it's important to recognize that some people have different needs. And so I heard someone who works on an international level who was being interviewed about what do they see as the next trend. And I heard this interview several years ago, and it was like, millennial coaching. He said, I have 10,000 coaches in my organization. I don't have one millennial coach. That's a need.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was like, okay, well, he sees the need and he's got 10. I don't have 10,000 coaches. I don't think I know 10,000 coaches. So I said, you know, that's as a smaller business owner, I need to pay attention to that. So I'm actively pursuing and working with people in the millennial generation to bring them up to be and train them as executive coaches.
And I think that's where I get a little bit lucky in that I've had the opportunity to work with every almost age group and sport for sure, but now that I'm transitioning a lot more to organizations and individuals and companies, it has been interesting to see that, because also I get the problem where a millennial will come in to teach a baby boomer group and there is the same type of issue that goes on maybe. And it is a age group thing, and I think it also is a referral thing. I get lucky enough to know people like you and several other coaches in the industry to be like, I'm not the best fit for you. And I think that's where you have to surrender a lot of your ego to get an individual better. And, you know, for myself, coming from a strength coach, I was always built to correct and then make them perform. It's not that way in this now, and you have to take so much of, we're not here to fix and correct. You know, and that's just it was very different for me when I started making that transition. So breaking off, you know, from that nice little tangent of millennials with millennials, what do you see that the millennials is just so different now than working with the baby boomers or anything else? What is the millennial group like, and what is going to be coaching them? How would a successful millennial coach a millennial?
Well, I'm not an expert in generational issues, but one of the things I think we know about millennials is that they're very self-directed, and they have high expectations, and they want to make a difference. And so I think there's some great qualities, and they're also used to technology in a very different way. I was on the cusp of things. I was in high school when I made the transition from most of your listeners won't know what this is. You can look at Google it. It's called a slide rule.
I don't even know what that is.
Yeah, so it was a slide rule. It was a mechanical thing that we used to figure out equations. And before calculators, we had slide rules. So when I was in high school in the 70s, I bought an HP calculator that cost me $100, which was a lot of money at that time. You can now buy a calculator with the same, well, there's an app for that, and it's free, and it does exactly what my $100 HP calculator used to do. So I was kind of on the cusp of a lot of change. We had computer programming. I took computer programming when it was all basic. We had cards, we printed cards. So I was kind of on the cusp of all that revolution. But a lot of people in my generation really aren't that technology friendly. So I think millennials, not that they're technology friendly, they don't know anything but that. So they wouldn't know what a slide rule is. Never heard of it. Haven't you always had calculators? Wasn't the world created, you know, and on the fifth day they created calculators or something?
Yeah.
Or computers or mobile phones or, you know, the internet and all that. So I think they have a different life experience that you have to honor in working with them. And I think the other thing is that they're not used to things taking a long time. They want to move quickly. So there is kind of a pace about how things are going to happen, and it's not a slow pace. It's like that. That's the world they're used to. So if you can't be helpful to me in that space, that's going to be a problem. Now, the other side of that is when people are accustomed to that, it's not a bad idea to help them understand that being reflective and pausing can be a good thing because when you don't reflect and you don't pause, you end up reacting a lot. And there's a real distinction between reaction and a response. A reaction is something you do automatically. A response is something that you think about and you make a choice about. If you're going to be able to make that choice, you're going to have to pause and insert the possibility of thinking about it so that you can actually make a decision about it. So that's a little bit of, you know, working with millennials is kind of sometimes recognizing their fast-paced environment, but also giving them some tools that might be helpful to them and they're not familiar with that would help them be more effective in that fast-paced environment.
And I've recommended this book before to the listeners where I've read EQ 2.0, mm-hmm. Emotional Intelligence, and you come up with more of an emotion versus a reason list. And for me, that really helps because being 31 and also being newly engaged, I react a lot with emotion sometimes. I've gotten much better at calming things down to look at the reason. I think that's one thing that millennials, we definitely struggle with because we see so much TV and media about being yourself and reacting, and instead of being reflective, instead of thinking and taking a night to sleep on it. And it's unique to see. And I've talked a lot to people about how I think technology can have its really big perks, but it has its really big drawbacks.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest thing I think for a drawback is we've forgotten the art of reading and really going into an in-depth of a book and how to read fast. And I think that art is being lost. And for me, reading is a lot of how I learn. So, you know, we've gotten used to doing things like podcasts and all these other things now, which are great, but the art of reading has really been one that I think has been left in the wayside.
And what you lose with that is in-depth knowledge. So you end up having surface knowledge, but you really don't understand it. So you know about it. And actually, I had a coaching session this morning making that distinction. One thing to know something about something. It's another thing to have an in-depth knowledge in order to do things differently based on that knowledge. So, I learned about emotional intelligence. I know what it is. Emotional intelligence is essentially being self-aware enough to manage your own emotions and then also being aware of others to manage your relationships. Okay, that's a soundbite for emotional intelligence. You go, I understand what that is. I see, you do. Has it shifted your behavior at all? Are you acting more emotionally intelligent as a result of that? That becomes a better question than just saying, I heard about that. I heard a 15-second blip on it.
Yeah.
So the reading really, or the training that allows people to have a more in-depth knowledge so that they can operationalize the knowledge and not just be aware of it. Awareness is great. Insight is great. And it's a first step. But it's like recognizing it'd be good to hire you to work with me as a strength and conditioning coach. That's great. But now you've got a learning curve about what that really means.
Yeah. It's always different for me because when I've stepped up that learning curve now that I read more and I've got the knowledge developing instead of just being there, I've noticed a lot, especially with the emotional intelligence stuff, I knew what it was, but then when you read about it and you actually practice it, I still don't score that well in self-awareness. That's actually one of my lowest categories.
Mm-hmm.
I think I scored a 78. I'm getting better at it, but it's still something I continually work on. And it's hard. It's really hard.
Well, I'm glad you said that because it's been one of the major things that's been out there in organizational work and working with executive coaching, because I think executive coaches do help people with emotional intelligence. It's one of the things that I focus on in terms of executive presence. If we go back to executive presence is really about having good emotional intelligence as a foundation. And it is hard. And so oftentimes the language out there is not very helpful because they say, well, things like emotional intelligence, aren't those soft skills? Okay, I just think that's not the best way to describe it, because learning how to do something in terms of a skill set about how to lift something is one thing, but learning emotional intelligence is really hard work. It's hard work. And so we do it a disservice by calling it a soft skill because it's one, it's a foundational skill and it's hard to learn. It takes work.
And it takes a lot of work. It has been a struggle. I will not lie to all the listeners out there. You guys have witnessed it on YouTube that I've struggled with those. and you witnessed the emotion versus reasons list when I got a little emotional there on YouTube. So what happened was I made the emotion versus reason list, and then when I overreact, I have certain emotions, and I had to write them down, and it wasn't making me very happy. So some of the listeners got to see that, and they got quite entertained by it with the comments. But it is unique because, you know, same thing when I break down squat form or when I'll break down a lunge form. You know, there's about 100 and something moving parts in the body going on at that time. Watching all of them is almost impossible. I get lucky with technology, but watching eyes for that and having ears for that is something that comes with time, and it is a really big struggle to work on because you have to constantly change your art. For whatever individual you're working with, the foundation stays the same, but every person's different. So it's always unique.
Yeah, and one of the things that I appreciate about you is that you're willing to do the investment in learning that in order to be more helpful to people. So if you recognize that that's a place where it might be a weakness for you, you're willing to work on that. And that's really helpful because I'll say two things. One, there's a book called Difficult Conversations. It was put out by the Harvard Negotiation Project years ago. But one of the better things that came out of that book was that the chapter is called Either You Have Your Emotions or Your Emotions Have You.
Yeah.
And that was really kind of foundational to understanding emotional intelligence, because that's what happens when you get when your emotions have you is the reaction. When you have your emotions, that's the response. That's a different thing. The other thing is just learning enough that you can't take people where you have been unwilling to go yourself. So I'm constantly working to improve myself in order to lead people and coach people to a better place. So I need to be willing to do the investment. I need to work on my emotional intelligence. That's why I still have a coach. That's why I have a spiritual advisor. That's why I have a program about meditation, about working out, and the way that I eat. I mean, all those things come into play in terms of that. So the other thing is, and this might be an interesting thing for your listeners, is that one of the things I used to say when I trained therapists, I think is true of executive coaches, at the end of the day, you are the most important technology in the room. And so what have you done to update your technology? Are you running old hardware? Are you running old software? And if you are, you're going to be getting old, antiquated results. Okay. So as you well know, I mean, we are constantly having to update. And so if I'm the most dominant and important technology in the room, when I'm working with someone as an executive coach, I owe it to them as a customer to be able to provide them with the best experience. And I take that on personally as an integrity issue.
And it's the same way that I've coached a lot of executive, you know, what I like to say, the coachings is one thing. When it comes to working with strength coaches or anything, when I tell them the fact that I only work out 15 minutes a week now, but I take care of every other aspect of my life with incredible detail, it makes them seem like, okay, that's different than everything we've learned. But the reality is the research now is showing how little exercise can make a difference if your other things like nutrition, your meditation, your spirituality, your I like to call it, how many intelligent words are you getting in a day? How many do you read? How many do you get in? You know, I've shifted a lot of people's thinking to away from exercise and into other sides that are life to get much healthier. Mm-hmm. And it freaks some of them out. It does. I've gotten a lot of negative feedback as well as positive, but working out 15 minutes a week seems insane to people, but the results have been phenomenal because I tested it myself and then I found enough research to back it up. But you speak on a lot of those good points, because if we can't constantly evolve our knowledge, that's always a thing. But one thing I always like kind of wrapping up these interviews with, if you had to give three really good books, because I always like listeners to know the books that these, you know, coaches I bring on, what that you're reading now or that you'd suggest for someone that is looking to find some information on, you know, your favorite book or anything like that, where would you go for three favorite books? I stole Liberating Structures and Teaming from Mr. Kevin, so I want you guys to know those are the books why I suggest them, because I stole them from him. So
I would say if you're going to be working as an executive coach in organizations, one of my favorite books right now is a book called Reinventing Organizations by a guy named Frederick Laloux. And it's a great book because it's been one of the most disturbing books that I've read in a while, because he has a whole different way of looking at organizational life and a way of organizing it in a very different way. So that would be one that that really stands out for me. I think teaming is one that I'm encouraging people a lot, because I had the opportunity to work with the author Amy Edmondson. I facilitate an interprofessional practice conference for Kaiser Permanente on a national basis, and we brought her in as a speaker, and we had a chance to meet and talk and collaborate about what she was going to present. And I see teaming as essential to really kind of, what are those collaborative processes that are allowing people to be successful as a team? And people need to be successful as a team. So I say, go read that. That's a good book. I think the other is that anything around how to deal with conflict management. So my go-to book has always been Difficult Conversations. And now there's a million books out there, and I call them the adjective conversation books, because they're crucial, difficult. There's all kinds of modifiers for them, but I find that one of the things that people in general still struggle with is how to manage conflict. Most people haven't learned good ways of doing that, and so if they don't have a process, it's difficult. So I'll give you here's a concrete one for you, is that when I was a marriage and family therapist, I use difficult conversations all the time, especially when with engaged couples. Because I used to say, here's the deal. If you don't have a good process, conflict is what will get you back to seeing me someday down the road.
Yeah.
So in order to keep you out, in terms of you not having to visit me again, if you can learn and adopt a good process, then you're good. Because when you have a good process, you can pour in any topic. Money, sex, in-laws, children, family, career. It doesn't matter what the topic is. As long as you have a good process of dealing with it, you'll deal with it.
Yeah, and for the listeners who've seen, I've struggled with the engagement with some of the things just when it comes to wedding and planning and stuff. But I get lucky enough to Tiffany and I very much believe in doing premarital counseling, and we do it, and we find a lot of very good use in it, and it's been awesome. But Kevin, I want to thank you for coming. I appreciate always the great coaches we get to have on 360 Coaching. So any parting words, though, you want to give to our listeners, that words of wisdom from your career as a executive coach and as a marriage and family therapist?
I'll share a quote that it's my oldest daughter just turned 31 a couple of days ago, and this is her favorite quote. The most challenging thing about being in a relationship is coming to realize the other person isn't you. If you can hold on to that as a person in any relationship, and especially as an executive coach, you've started from a very good place, realizing the other person isn't you, and so they may be different, and how different are they? And if you can honor that difference, there's the co-creation of something pretty spectacular. So thank you for the opportunity to have this conversation with you and with your listeners.
Oh, I can't say enough how lucky we get in having the coaches we do, and especially having you on, because I know I've been trying to get you for a while. So to all the listeners that I promised before, we finally got them. So thank you guys for listening, and we'll look forward to probably having you on again at some point, because I always love talking to you, Kevin. But thank you guys. This is 360 Coaching with John Crismans. We're going to be coming at you again soon, but keep on listening and keep on commenting, and I will see you guys all soon.